Here I go again. It's reflections time again. I'll speak my mind again. One more time. Fassbinder's up again. The outlook is bleak again. Hopes will be dashed again. One more time. I've watched this before, and I'm watching it again. But it's not only me. No, sir. I'm watching it with friends. Here we go again. Shoot off our mouths again. Please listen in again. One more time. This is episode 16 of the Criterion Reflections Podcast. I am David Blakesley, taking you on a journey chronologically through the Criterion Collection, as today I take another look at Rainer Werner Fassbinder's 1970 film, Gods of the Plague. I've blogged it, I've podcasted about it, but like that one last drink or that femme fatale staring at me across the room, I just can't stay away. Yeah, I've been down this road before. I'm walking it again. With Josh Hornbeck and Jason Beamish as my sidekicks. This time I know. Yeah, I know. I'm gonna win. So here we go again. Acting like we really know. Again, just what we're talking about again. Yeah, just one more time. Just one more time. One more. Okay, guys, we are here to talk about Gods of the Plague, Götter der Pest, the third film by Rainer Werner Fassbinder, his follow-up to Katzelmacher, a sequel of sorts to Love is Colder Than Death, and the second part of an informal gangster trilogy that was followed up by The American Soldier, which will be coming up weeks or maybe months from now. I'm not sure exactly when. I am here with Josh Hornbeck. Good evening, Josh.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing good, and you are down in New Orleans, right? You're conferencing.
I am.
Out of the nest a little bit. Tell us a little bit what you got going on down there.
Yeah, just for work. I'm here at the Nonprofit Technology Conference and just learning a little bit about how to maybe do my job a little more effectively and take some tools back to work. So I'm excited. It's been fun so far.
Well, I am honored that of all the wild and crazy things you could be doing down there in New Orleans at night, you're here podcasting with me and also with Jason Beamish. Jason, how are you tonight?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you back. You guys are becoming kind of part of my regular posse here, frequent contributors, and I'm happy to have you on board as we get into yet another Fassbinder film. There's a lot of these on the docket. We've already covered a few in this podcast. Kind of reprised my conversation with Trevor Barrett for Love is Colder Than Death from the old Eclipse Viewer series. And then Jonathan Lobinger and I got together to talk about Katzelmacher back in the 1969 films. But here we are, early 1970, and we are here to talk about Gods of the Plague, which, like as I already said, is a bit of a crime noirish drama thing, starring those familiar faces. So, Jason, I'm going to kick it over to you to kind of just maybe summarize the film, give us a first take, and let the conversation roll from there.
Well, Gods of the Plague, as you had mentioned, it's part of a loose trilogy. I believe it was his third feature film. The film is about a young man who gets released from prison and, as all too often happens, manages to find his way back into the seedy underbelly. And just is visibly distraught, not sure that this is where he could even be anymore. And it just falls right back into the life that he had beforehand. And he's going between two women, and he meets up with his old friend, and his old friend who the police are actively searching for. And it kind of just, it's a very slow boil. It feels like a play, but it's one of the early films that inspired many other to come after it.
Yeah. Fassbinder's definitely playing with some conventions of the gritty, hard-boiled crime film, the little love triangle, the ex-con who doesn't really know what it takes to go straight. But there's definitely some very Fassbinderian feel to it. Again, the cast is kind of an interchangeable, rotating crew here. And the more I kind of immerse myself in this world, the more fond and intrigued I find myself getting, even through those kind of slow-moving, slow-burning parts. Jason, did you like it? Did you enjoy this?
I struggled with it. Mm-hmm. It really, it's very clear that this is a early feature on a shoestring budget of a man who appears to have idolized Godard, because I can see Alphaville in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it, but I wouldn't say that it's the best Fassbender that I had seen, but I would certainly not tell people to not watch it.
Well, we'll get into a little bit more of your background and the Fassbinder context. Let's go ahead and get Josh's take here. What do you think?
Yeah, I've seen a number of Fassbinder's films, but I hadn't seen this one yet. And I kind of felt a lot like Jason did at the beginning. I wasn't really all that keyed into it. I found myself getting a little lost from time to time with some of the plot twists. I was so engaged and engrossed by the style and the compositions that I would miss the one bit of dialogue that explained what happened. Mm-hmm. and how those connections were being made. But when I rewatched it just last night, I was really struck by it feels in some ways like you have these characters who are almost play acting at noir, that they're going through all the motions, they're going through all of the rituals and the plot points and the beats of noir, but it feels like it's an exercise rather than anything that's motivated by the characters. And I just found that really fascinating and made me want to dig into it maybe a little more than I had on my first viewing.
Yeah, I definitely hear where you're coming from. There's a little bit of a put on here. You know, they're kind of, not exactly paper dolls, not just cutouts. I mean, there is some depth, there is some emotion here. But one of the things that strikes me is that Yeah, these people are all really young to be as burned out as they are. And I'm sure Fassbinder is, you know, is giving some social commentary about just the dreariness of this scene. You know, there's an early line, the main character, Franz Walsh, when he first gets out of jail and he reunites with Johanna, and you know, the first scene after he's kind of done his little walk past the bricks, now he's a free man. He goes to a cafe, he gets on a phone, he makes a call trying to track down Johanna, and it's like you think, wow, he's ready to get back with his gal, you know, and kind of pick up his old life. But when he sees her, his face is just stone cold. There's no expression, there's no nothing. And you know, she's definitely trying to rekindle the flame. She's happy to see him. You can see that little gasp of anticipation as he kind of settles into her dressing room. She's kind of doing a Marlena Dietrich ripoff strip number, although you never really see her disrobe, you know, but there's a pretty loose lip syncing going on there. And it's definitely a very theatrical little bit there, a little bit of homage for Fassbinder as he's single-handedly reviving German cinema. Und ein kleines dummes Kinderlächeln, das ich doch in Träumen immer nur seh. Mein blondes Baby, vergiss mich nicht. Mein kleines Baby, tu sowas nicht. Du ahnst ja gar nicht, was du mir bist, weil deine Seele ein Baby ist, mein kleines Baby. Oh, hör mir zu, in bist du nur du. Hör meine Seele. Hyperbolic a little bit there, but you know, he's definitely drawing on some of those old traditions. Of course, even film noir, even these gangster dramas kind of go back to the golden age of German cinema. But you know, he says, you know, well, she says, well, how you feel? And he said, well, you know, it's the same out here as it was inside. I mean, he's a little bit more economical in his expression, his exact wording, but that's pretty much the point. It's like, you know, not just prison where he was, but life itself is a prison, or at least Munich is a prison, or the stratum of society that he's been born into and is locked in is just like a jail. So, yeah, so he's really, you know, the flat affect just kind of permeates this whole scene. Everybody takes about 5 or 10 seconds to gather their thoughts, it seems, and say whatever their response is to whatever somebody else has just done.
What struck me this time through is just how, you know, again, we have the affect that is in a lot of Fassbinder's films, but just how vibrant Hannah Shigula's performance is as mm-hmm. Joanna. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just really impressive. And she's able to fit within the Fassbinder world and yet somehow stand apart from it at the same time. It's really striking what she brings to the roles and what she brings to the film.
Yeah, she's a radiant burst of sun, even though her role is conflicted and depressive. But, you know, well, I mean, she just has this presence, this persona. Of course, a beautiful face, a magnetism, a charisma, and Fassbinder, and she met, you know, several years earlier, and he just kind of knew that she was going to be his cinematic muse. And you know, you talk about the Godard and Anna Karina, and it's very similar chemistry and magnetism going on here.
Yeah.
Jason, are you a Hannah Shigula fan?
I am.
Yeah, sure.
The first thing I had seen her in was The Marriage of Maria Braun.
Sure. That was my first Fassbinder many years ago. That was the one that, for whatever reason, kind of rose to the top and got a lot of critical acclaim. And So, yeah, and of course, by that point, she had really matured into pretty much a leading female actor, really carried a very, you know, heavy role, a lot of nuance here. This is a little simpler, but, you know, there again, there's just this vibrancy to her presence. And, of course, the other significant female lead, Margaret von Trotta, you know, she's a little bit more focused, a little bit more subdued, but still a very heavy, very significant presence in this film, as the two of them kind of constitute sort of the main love triangle, but there's actually other women involved as well. How many, have either of you guys seen Love is Colder Than Death?
I have not.
I watched about half of it last night.
Okay. Oh, okay. So Jason's watched half of it and Josh has not seen it.
I have not seen that one. So I actually went into this not knowing that it was the second part of a trilogy.
Yeah.
And, and I've actually also seen The American Friend. I saw that years ago, just randomly. And so I had no idea that this was part of the Franz Walsh trilogy when I went into it. But I actually don't know that it affected too much of my
it shouldn't enjoyment have of it. And there's some interesting little games going on here, because in Love is Colder Than Death, and I think you meant The American Soldier. American Friend is the Wim Wenders film, but
oh yes, yes,
easy,
sorry,
easy to confuse there. But before all the, you know, the hate mail comes in.
Yes, we'll thank you for helping me correct that.
but in Love is Colder Than Death, Fassbinder plays the Franz Walsh character. And he and Johanna at the end of the film kind of get away. Although, if you are going to linearly connect these films, then apparently Franz Walsh, the character, was arrested and put in jail. And when he goes into jail, he's kind of the pudgy, kind of wide-faced Fassbinder. When he comes out, he's the lean and dapper Harry Barr. Jail really changes a guy, it seems.
Yes.
But in The American Soldier, the Franz Walsh character, once again, is played by Fassbinder. So, you know, again, I talked about the interchangeable parts of these actors. But there's also some formal things going on here. Love is Colder Than Death is really stark minimalism. Some of the blankness of the acting and the long stretches of silence and lack of dialogue, I kind of surmise is a way of kind of padding the film out, because he was making it on a truly shoestring budget. Here you see some technical progression. You see, you know, helicopter shots. You see some, you know, foreground, midground, background, deep focus stuff going on. So, you know, his technical game is definitely stepping up, and I think his ability to reproduce some of the effects and the atmosphere and the emotions of classic film noir is definitely stepped up quite as well. So let's just talk a little bit about this story. I mean, in my sense, I don't think the story itself is crucial, because you're right, these characters are kind of going through some motions. They're conspiring to pull off a job, but it's of such a mundane quality, and there's really such little suspense to this. Isn't Rafifi. Okay. So what is it that pulled you in? And again I hear that you guys maybe struggled with this to find that connection point, but what were your connection points? What did you kind of find that stood out to you about this particular film?
I think on a second viewing for me, what stood out was that the plot is less about the bank heist that's going to be played, or
the supermarket.
The supermarket heist that we think it might be a bank heist. We don't know what it's going to be. And then when he reveals that it's a supermarket heist, it's such a petty, a petty thing. But it really is the thrust of Franz's motivation seems to be to find his friend, the gorilla. And then it really becomes about that relationship and that bond between he and between Marguerite and the three of them together in this kind of Jules and Jim like relationship. I found that really fascinating, just how strong that bond was between the three characters. And the complications that arise from that, I think those are the things that drew me in a little bit more beyond just the fun of seeing Fassbender style at play in a gangster film. I think story-wise, I was really intrigued to see where that relationship and where those dynamics were going to go.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there is an emotional undercurrent here of connection, of trust, of betrayal, of longing. It's not played up, and there is that kind of deadpan irony that sort of, you know, just before you can really get deep into the sincerity of the emotions, there's a bit of clowning around. I'm thinking about the fight scene that takes place out at the farm where they're kind of reconnecting with Joe, who's seems to be somewhat of a criminal mastermind, or a guy who kind of can tell him, here's some marks, here's some targets. And so they're kind of heading out to make some plans after Franz and the gorilla have reconnected there. But what is that fight all about? I mean, it really feels like boys just kind of, you know, play acting here. And then the next scene, after they've been clobbering and kicking and smashing each other, and they all kind of wind up passed out on the ground, now they're just having breakfast at the table like nothing even happened there. So is this tongue in cheek? Is this kind of jaded irony here, or is there something a little bit more genuine, a little bit more, you know, human and feeling going on, despite kind of all the scars and bruises, at least emotionally, that these characters are bearing?
Well, I think you have to roll the clock back. If we were to assign an age for these men, what, like mid to late 20s, perhaps?
Yeah, I would think so. Maybe even earlier 20s, like 23, 24 type of thing. So they don't seem like they've really experienced a lot, at least at my current frame of reference here. But they've been through a lot, you know, and I think that's, again, he's trying to kind of portray this somewhat lost generation.
Well, it's difficult, you know, for someone of my age now to really, because I mean, if you were to roll back, say they're 23 and this was 1970, that would have put them growing up at the onset of the Reconstruction.
I think so. Gunter Kaufmann was actually born in like 46 or 47. His dad was an American GI, a black man who was stationed over there, and then he left, I think, even before Gunter Kaufmann, the gorilla character. So, you know, he really is a post-war, a baby boomer, so to speak. And 46, 47 to 70, that is 23 years old. So, you know, he's really just a young man coming of age. But he's, you know, very, very virile, great masculine presence there. But you know, again, and at that time of life, of course, relationships are pretty fluid. The emotions are strong. The sexual attractions are powerful. But the commitment isn't always there. And there's a lot of sorting out and growing up going on in these characters, even though they're also playing some pretty high stakes games with their involvement in criminal activities, you know, prostitution, pornography, gambling. There's kind of an adrenaline fueled thing going on here, yet they don't really seem to be, you know, enjoying themselves at all.
Yeah. Plus, at this point, Gunter Kaufmann and Fassbender were in a relationship, a romantic relationship. So they're also throwing that into the mix.
Could
be portraying, you know, the sexual ambiguity that they're trying to figure out. You know, before this, you know, Franz may have felt like women were the only thing for him. And now when he lashes out near the end of the film because she hits Gunter, you know, you start to see that what you were saying, fluidity, except on a, you know, a hetero versus homosexual relationship.
Right.
Go ahead.
I mean, Gunter Kaufmann was actually married with children at this time, even though he was still a pretty young man. You know, he had a family. Fassbender was himself a bit of a homewrecker, you could say, you know? And Kaufmann himself, you know, wasn't you know, completely as obsessed or enraptured with Fassbinder as it was on the other side of that equation. And that itself created some tensions, and Fassbinder, there's a film not included in the Eclipse series set called Whitey, which is apparently an antebellum story from the American South of the 1850s or something like that, with racial overtones, obviously. I would love to see it. And actually that film, the making of story became kind of the genesis of Beware of a Holy Whore, which is the one color film from this early Fassbinder set, which, again, we'll get into in our sequence somewhere down the road. And that's a very fascinating, because here, in that film, Fassbinder's got another actor. I can't remember the guy's name right offhand, but it's the guy who's in Fists in the Pocket, another Criterion release, playing sort of a version of himself as this tyrannical director who kind of goes bonkers on the set. Very interesting. It just gets you into this whole, the cult of RWF, which, I recently, of course, getting this season of this podcast started while talking about the Volker Schlondorf film Baal, starring again Fassbinder with cameos from a lot of the same cast and a pretty significant contribution from Margaret von Trotta, just kind of pulls me into a whole nother level as Volker Schlondorf very presciently cast Fassbinder as this kind of incarnation of Bertolt Brecht, seminal character from Brecht's very first written play. So just an amazing confluence of literary and theatrical talents and influences coming to play in these early films.
Yeah, and they were making so many of them at the same time. I mean, you just talked about Ball a few weeks ago, and that was made right along with this film, and he was also doing theater. It just is a fascinating output from any artist. And I was really struck by the notion that these are young men that really don't always know what they want in life. They're trying to find it, but in a way that it might be hard for us to understand today. I think a lot of the affect also feels like an attempt to kind of put up those walls between what they're really feeling. Mm-hmm. So there's that really beautiful moment in the car when Franz asks the gorilla if he is the one who killed his brother. Mm-hmm. And he says yes. And then he looks over at Franz looks over at the gorilla and says, "I love you." And you get this, there's all of these weird mixtures and contrasting impulses. And
right, the guy who killed his brother because it was just business, his brother talked, mm-hmm. and were you with Johanna while I was in prison?
Yes.
Well, I love you anyways. It's like, yeah, so where is the loyalty? What is their heart really seeking in all of this, and That is the part to me, beyond the style, beyond the clear advances in cinematic effect, technique, atmosphere. It is that confusion and that fatigue and that ennui that has set in. It really is. It is tragic at the end of it all. And I think that is again where there is underneath all those layers of irony and burnout and cynicism, there's still a yearning for something humane and genuine and authentic. Despite the violence and the pretty obvious wastefulness of so many poor, immature choices that are going on, almost constantly throughout the film.
Yeah, and right after that, as they're driving in the car, I believe it's right after that, it cuts to the helicopter shot of the car and that lush, romantic music. Yeah. that that wouldn't feel out of place in the later melodramas that he does. One of the books that I was kind of perusing while preparing for this talked about the idea that this serves in some ways as a bridge or a signifier that this is the direction he's going to be going, the melodrama route, the Douglas Sirk route. You see some of the seeds being planted here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fassbender had two, in those early years, I guess he had two categories of films. He had cinema films that were more self-referential to the medium and the history of film, and then he had social films that I guess were about, you know, more human characters and real, just kind of psychological issues, melodramas, not so much tributes, but really just trying to get down to what's really happening in society here. Jason, what do you think? I mean, how do you think this film works as social commentary for, there's the obvious, the immediate context of Munich and, you know, kind of the Cold War era depression that kind of beset German society. It's such a contrast to the hippie flower power, easy rider, dynamic energy of American cinema of people of the same age. But how do you relate to the sort of the social setting and the context and the portrayal of a generation of people kind of coming of age?
Well, I see two questions there. The coming of age, obviously, you know, I have not been to prison. I was not incarcerated, so I didn't have to have, you know, a nearly as difficult a life as these people would have. However, I was listless and unimpressed with life at that point in my mm-hmm. years.
Sure.
Know, just kind of we'll make it work. I didn't have, you know, I was not in like the free love area. I was certainly not in a former conflict zone. But I can completely relate to the idea of this is just life now. You know, they told me it would not be easy. Mm-hmm. I now understand it. So I'll just exist until I can kind of maybe figure it out. Mm-hmm. But then on the other side of a possible social commentary, whether or not it was Fassbender's intent. How could he assume what would relate to, you know, 2000, 18? I don't remember anymore. Feels like 2030. But just the idea of the life that you're going to live as a ex-convict, or regardless of how long you are imprisoned, you know, the recidivism, all that kind of stuff, how difficult your life becomes because you've been locked away, whether you were, you know, in solitary, whether you were able to develop any relationships on the inside, and just how starkly different the life is when you walk out the door. You've been through this emotional trauma that these other people, especially for like the guerrilla who should have been in prison, whether mm-hmm. or not he was, they don't really get into that, or if he was for any period of time.
He's on his way. I mean, the cops are on his trail. They're just looking for him to slip up or even reemerge so they can arrest him because he mm-hmm. is in hiding, right?
That's right. That's right. So, you know, it's so... there's such a tie-in to modern society with the prison rates as they stand today,
and even the police corruption. You know, this cop who is, you know, his assignment is to track down the gorilla, and then of course Franz's brother Marian winds up dead in an apartment under the name of Schlondorf, a little inside joke there. but and so now we've got a genuine murder on our hands, and the cops think they knew who the suspect is. But you get a little bit of that procedural, you know, behind the scenes cop mm-hmm. stuff. And he's, of course, he's messing with Johanna as a way of both getting some inside information and as well as getting his rocks off with a, mm-hmm. with a beautiful young woman. So he's definitely playing it dirty on both sides there. And again, reminds me of the film I just released most recently, A Citizen of Above Suspicion, there, where it's another kind of dirty cop story set in Italy, this time in a much more kind of symbolic and a little more energized setting there. And then even at the end of the film where the cop, you know, very clearly plants a gun to set up, you know, what turned out to be pretty much an execution style intervention on the policeman's part. But he plants the gun, the weapon in the dead man's hands just to kind of cover his own tracks. So there is definitely some social commentary about the, you know, the corruption, the duplicity, even the title of the film. What do you guys think about Gods of the Plague? There's a little insight that I can tell you about, but what was your takeaway as far as why did Fassbinder perhaps choose that particular title for this story?
You know, I think the only thing that I haven't done a lot of digging into it, but I think the thing that strikes me is that he was really interested in that disaffection of post-war German youth, and it just strikes me that the plague could very easily be that sense of alienation, that real desire to connect with another person, but the inability to do that. That's something that I feel like I see running throughout his work, and so the plague strikes me as that disaffection and that inability to connect, and well, these are people who are pretty good at remaining disaffected and maintaining that connection or maintaining that sense of disconnection. Yeah.
How about you, Jason? What's your thoughts on the title?
Going into it, it sounded like a really, really bad gang name. Like a bunch of street toughs get together and start calling themselves the Gods of the Plague.
Right.
But what I can just listening to this conversation so far, I'm getting a lot more out of it than I did on my own. I can easily see it being that they have been the victims of the plague, that the generation before them created, and they're just trying to cope.
Yeah, well, you guys are both pretty much on the right track. If I will actually embed this in the show notes, but there's a German trailer that you can find on YouTube, and even if you don't, there's no subtitles, but even if you don't speak German, there's a tagline I think it's Fassbinder's voice, throws in at the end, which is basically, criminals are the gods and capitalism is the plague, or criminals are the gods and capitalism. Okay. So, basically these are the criminals of capitalism. And I will say this, that for all the flat affect, for the draining of emotion, even when that scene where Franz Walsh is stripped down, you know, literally down to nothing but his socks by this, you know, beautiful woman in this kind of flimsy negligee type of thing. He is just laying there practically catatonic. I mean, she's got her hand like right there on his thigh, and there's not even a response. I mean, I think the only motion is that he pulls up his hand to take a drag off his cigarette. This guy is, you know, burned to a crisp and almost incapable of arousal, even in a kind of what you might consider an ideal situation, hedonistically speaking here. But you know, he also, there's also this kind of almost semi-divine posture that he's in. It actually reminds me of some of those paintings of Christ being taken down off the cross, those kind of medieval Renaissance figures there. And he is kind of beatified in a way. Is his death a martyr-like type of thing? I wouldn't exactly say that, but there is the sense of tragic futility to it all as well. So, you know, he's photographed very lovingly. There's scenes of him kind of grooming his mustache, and you know, he's aware of his physical attractiveness, and I think that's another just interesting piece of casting. Fassbinder in this role wanted to make the Franz Walsh character a little bit more of a tragic ideal, whereas in the other films he was just a tough, he was just a kind of a rowdy, and that's more the Fassbinder character himself. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, just some really interesting layers of context and juxtaposition that I guess reveal themselves over time. That this may feel like a kind of a quickie one-off, you know, let's just put a plot together, let's string a few scenes along, let's have the characters portray these classic noir archetypes. And there is, those were all valid observations and takeaways from that, you know, first or second layer of exposure. I've lived with these films for a few years now. I've seen these characters kind of in other contexts, and this does feel like a pretty genuine expression, kind of a heartfelt confession, if you will, of the young Fassbinder as he's kind of reckoning with his talent, his voice, his vision. Where does he want to take his cinema? And so I think this is an important film, even though it's early and can be seen as maybe a little bit more disposable. I'll recommend one particular link in the show notes by, it's a site called Jim's Reviews, and he's writing from as he puts it, a GLBT perspective. And he's, you know, got a pretty good archive. He's reviewed all of the available Fassbinder films, and he's very insightful, very deep student. And apparently, according to his resources, Fassbinder considered this his fifth best film. So take that for what it is, you know. So I think a lot of it is the value that it had to him as an emerging artist. I think he probably went on to accomplish greater things in terms of sort of the well-rounded cinematic experience and plotting and acting and everything else. But I think this is a pretty pivotal film for him in his own development.
Yeah, and I think for me, when I remarked earlier that it feels like they're play-acting the noir, that to me actually feels, it helped me read the film a little differently, that you have these people posing and putting on airs and trying to do things maybe they don't, maybe trying to cover for their real feelings, trying to cover and trying to not be vulnerable with each other. I thought, as you were mentioning Franz's catatonia, he really doesn't come to life until the gorilla enters the scene.
Right.
And you get that sense of joy, as joyful as the film can get. And I find the whole thing really fascinating, and it's made me want to just continue to dig. One other moment that just kind of keeps coming back to me is in the police station. It's a small moment, but about halfway through the film, the police captain says, you know, we're not getting anywhere. We have to take dramatic steps. And you don't really ever know why they care this much about finding the gorilla. You don't really know why any of that's in place. It's just that, well, we're in a crime thriller, and the police have to intensify their pressure, so we need a scene where the captain yells at the other cop. And yet it works in this really fascinating way.
Now, going off of that, with the idea of play acting as the characters, it's like they're play acting as adults because they haven't really figured out what they're supposed to do yet.
And that is kind of what young adults do, right? They're often play acting roles or taking on new personas or adopting fads or styles, because that's just a way of being and making an impression of expressing something that's inside, or at least experimenting with that feeling, with that attitude.
And one thing that I certainly took away from the film is how, while it is complex when you really sit down and unpack everything, it is very simple. I've been studying German off and on. I cannot speak it to save my life. Well, maybe to save my life, but I can't speak it well enough. But I'll tell you one thing. I want to say maybe 75% of it I could understand in this, whereas I've seen plenty of German films where I would be absolutely lost without the subtitles. So, you know,
so this is kind of a rudimentary German, or a basic simple vocabulary, or certainly the slower laconic enunciation. They're not, you know, rattling it off at a fast pace, and maybe a more fluent German-speaking audience would understand. Yeah. Right?
Like if it was like a Philip Marlowe-style noir.
Snappy patter.
Yeah.
It would be impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, to try and translate it on the fly. But I'm coming around to it more talking to you guys.
Yeah, well, that's often the effect of these things. And again, yeah, there is a simple, a deceptively simple quality to these films. And it's short. It's like, what, 88 minutes, 80, something like that. So it's not like you're really having to sink into something. And so the rewatchability of these early films is also, I think, an asset because you can kind of take a quick spin around, get into it a little bit deeper, feel the characters fleshing out a little bit as you start understanding what's behind the faces and the expressions and the silences. I think there is meaning that's conveyed in those quiet moments or those the way Fassbinder uses mirrors and frames these shots and these expressive faces. I mean, he really does have a very visually appealing cast. Of course, again, a lot of them are young people. He's picked them out for their theatrical acting abilities, but also just their expressiveness. And he has a nice knack for framing the human face and for letting the eyes and the mouth and the body language tell stories that words don't necessarily have to, expound upon. And I really like that style and that craft.
Yeah, the style just again really, really blew me away. Knowing that this was his third film, knowing that this was so early, and just seeing how confident the framing is, how assured it is, that opening credit sequence as well, just I was blown away by it.
The
kind
music.
Of Chiron scrolling text below and the dance and
I don't know if that was Ray Charles or who that was, but what do you guys think of the music too? I mean, you've already alluded, Josh, to that kind of romantic lush music with the long shot helicopter, but there's some really interesting musical bits. I actually did a little bit of recording the other night, just kind of pulling some sound samples. I'll maybe sprinkle a few throughout the episode or intros and outros. That little record plays that little nonsense song about the animals.
Die Schildkröte, die Schildkröte, blies im Orchester Trompete. Das Chamäleon, das blies den dicken Bombardon. Die Läuse, die machten ein Gesäuse. Die Hummel, die schlug die große Trommel. Der Aal, der Schwänzel durch den Saal. Der Leopard, der hat auf seine Gattin gewart. Der Flamingo, der sucht einen Platz sich irgendwo. Der Esel, der...
Well, and I kind of think that that's an important moment in it. I think that for a lot of these characters, they feel like their life is nonsense. They feel like they're just kind of going through this endless parade of poverty and jail and crime and lovers, and it doesn't mean much to them moment.
I think the performer's name was Carl Valentin, and I looked that up on YouTube as well, and the German Charlie Chaplin is one way that he was referred to. And so you almost imagine that was a record that was made for the amusement of children or maybe family entertainment type of record. And so you're taking what it might be the equivalent of like the Mickey Mouse Club soundtrack from the 1950s and playing it in this kind of traumatized, grief-stricken setting. It's like, wow, it kind of warps the context right there.
Well, it also is, it sounds almost like a cry for how his life used to be. I imagine he had listened to that song intently as a child.
But it's not bringing back those warm, fuzzy memories, right?
No, they're gone. And I think he regrets, I would hope that he regrets some of the decisions that he's made. But
it was also striking that at his mother's place, she puts on this very militaristic march. That also seems to be trying to hearken back to an era that is bygone and can't come back and shouldn't come back.
Right.
And
when things were orderly and disciplined.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And there's this real irony in that scene, and she's so involved in the music, and I find some of those choices of the practical music so fascinating.
Do you guys know that woman, the mother, was actually Fassbinder's real-life mother?
That does not surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I was thinking about, you know, these scenes where after her sons both have died in the course of this film, my hunch is that Fassbinder's real-life mother probably outlived her son as well. I mean, of course, nobody knew where the story was headed. But I think he was what 36 when he died, or really, really young, you know. And it's like, man, and again, every time I talk about him, I just think about what a waste. But that was the life that he lived on his terms. Yeah. And of course, the film kind of ends on that note of three women grieving Franz Walsh, and it's again, at this point, the play acting has kind of receded. This is some real sincere grief and loss for these women who loved a young man who had really lost his way. You know, his parting words, you know, stick with what you know, as he's dying in the aisle of a supermarket. Again, kind of a grim irony, but also a warning in that. And then the gorilla's parting words, you know, life is precious even now, as he stumbles and dies after just killing Carla, the pornography peddler. I mean, what a gripping, sad scene that was. The first time through, it's like, oh boy, a little over the top. But once you kind of connect with these characters, it's like, it's just awful. It's really heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah. Talking about his mother, the book that I've been kind of skimming is called Understanding Fassbinder, Film as Private and Public Art by Wallace Stedman Watson. And he actually worked with the Fassbinder Foundation. And the Fassbinder Foundation was founded by his mother in order to preserve his legacy after he passed away. And so she founded it, and then his editor, his longtime editor, took it over afterwards. But the people who were really closest to him really wanted to safeguard the work that he did. And the fact that his mother's in a lot of his films, you get the sense that she really... she really respected and, again, was really protective of his art. And I find that really, really beautiful.
Yeah, well, it's quite an amazing legacy. And I can imagine, you know, even though I was alive and I kind of knew a little, I mean, I knew about The Marriage of Maria Braun when it came out in the late 70s. I was still a teenager at the time, and it wasn't until after he had passed that I got around to finally seeing that movie. But I knew little bits and pieces about the legend of this, you know, crazy German wild man filmmaker. But I imagine because of the extreme productivity and you know, his precocious nature, you know, he almost maybe took it for granted that that's just what he does. He just, you know, cranks them out. And I think the pace had slowed a little tiny bit by the end of his career, but then he passed on, again, kind of a self-destructive fury that did him in. but I'm glad that you know, the Fassbinder Foundation has a great website. I've actually linked to it. I didn't know his mother was as crucially involved in putting it together, but it's a pretty cool legacy and a pretty cool testimony. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of grief that went into her efforts as well, you know, missing a really wonderful and amazingly talented young man.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, guys, this has been a great conversation. Any final comments or thoughts you want to throw out there? I mean, you know, I think we've covered it pretty nicely. I've enjoyed the chance to revisit. Like I say, I've written about this. I've blogged about it a few years ago, talked about it with Trevor. Links to all of that old stuff is in the show notes there. But this has been a great re-exploration of this film. And again, a lot more Fassbinder to come in this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, I've seen quite a bit of Fassbinder, and every time I think I've seen all there is, there's more to find, and I find that really lovely. I really like, especially as we get into his later work, I really, really connect with a lot of what he's doing there, and so it's really fun to see the beginnings of that, and to see how he starts to play with some of his stylistic and thematic concerns, even here.
Yeah, and to think that he was doing, like, this was, I mean, between Love is Colder Than Death and this, he had not even been making films for a year. It's just unbelievable, yeah. Jason, any last comments you want to throw in there?
I, on the other side of this, have seen relatively few of his, so I have this whole odyssey left to go. I was not in a big hurry because, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of things to watch.
Of course.
Yeah.
So I mean, you guys have a much deeper knowledge of him as a director and as a man, but it's crazy to look at a man who, you know, had a working career as short as he did, but had an output as vast when you consider that, you know, in the same amount of time it takes, you know, Quentin Tarantino to make a movie, you know, he made, you know, 15.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're
solid stuff, you know, and he's not just the guy behind the camera. He's writing, he's casting, he's, you know, he's very immersed in almost all details of it. I'm sure he's selecting the music. He's, you know, and of course he's got a team around him. He's not the cinematographer, but he did the editing on this film as well, you know, so he really
he's also doing theater and acting in other films too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A force of nature.
a tremendous amount of cocaine is all I can
imagine. But you know, there's a lot of other people who are doing that stuff and they're not really producing the work.
No, but they're living.
Yeah. So. Well, guys, maybe we'll have you on. There's a lot more Fassbinder to choose from, so I'm sure we'll have a chance to revisit and dig deeper into the oeuvre there, right there. So we all got to start somewhere, Jason, so I'm glad I could bring you along on the journey tonight. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back with you real soon.
Here we go again. She's back in town again. I'll take her back again. One more time. I'll be her fool again. One more time. I've been there before, and I'll try it again. But any fool knows that there's no way to win. Here we go again. break my heart again. I'll play the part again. What?